The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. I've got Jim in studio here. He's digging up some questions. We've got a slew of questions again in this week. He'll surprise me with them, as he usually does, but I'm pretty sure he's going to start out with a couple of Social Security questions, which is our tradition here whenever we have them. Like the intro said, if you do have your questions that you'd like to submit to the show here, just go to jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And you can submit them right through there. So, Jim, any exciting developments you need to share before we dive into Social Security question number one?
Exciting developments. Nothing. Well, yeah. I told you. I haven't told my listeners. I'm going under the knife. What is it, about 2.5 weeks from now? The 29th.
That sounds so dramatic.
Well, I am going to go under a knife. That's a euphemism.
It's a little,
for an operation.
It's just a little tiny incision.
To you, it's a little tiny incision. To me, I'm going under the knife. But yours truly, folks, has been diagnosed with, what did he call it? I think he used the word persistent. Persistent AFib. And which means I'm in AFib 100% of the time. And I didn't know. Don't feel it. So I told all listeners, if you don't know the whole story, I apparently have AFib, and it caused me to have a very significant stroke in November. Go back and listen to the shows we did on all that. But I want people, listeners, please, if you or if you know anyone who has AFib, please take it seriously. Yours truly didn't. I was told my chance of a stroke was so minimal, I didn't take it serious, and I suffered a major, major stroke. But now, Chris, they put one of them monitor things back on me and found that I have am in AFib 100% of the time. When I was first diagnosed with AFib, you know, when I had that incident in Boulder in 2019, I was only in AFib 20% of the time. So somehow between 2019 and my stroke in 2020, I kicked into what is known as persistent AFib, and I never leave it. I'm constantly in it, at least according to the monitor that I wore for several weeks. So anyways, they're going to do a procedure on me called an ablation, where according to Chris is no big deal.
Well, I've known several people that had a very positive experience with it.
Oh, did they stay up and drink cocktails as it was happening?
No, but shortly thereafter.
Well, maybe you're not worried, but yours truly is. It's one thing.
Well, I don't blame you for being worried.
When I was having my stroke and I was nearly dead on the gurney anyways, I could care less what they were doing. Now I'm just sitting here freaking out all the time, knowing that they're going to go inside my heart, Chris, and cauterize areas of it. You know what that means? They're going to burn it. They're going to barbecue my heart while I'm alive.
You'll be asleep. You won't notice.
True. But if any listeners are out there who have had an ablation, for better or worse.
No, only if it was for better. Don't contact him if it didn't work.
Well, they can contact me and give me, you know, should I be freaking out?
How about encouragement? That would be good.
Or should I be like Chris is, who thinks I'm a little wuss right now?
I never said that. Now you're exaggerating.
Imply it. You imply it.
I'm just trying to calm you down a little.
That ain't going to happen.
Okay.
It's too late for that. When they diagnosed me with persistent AFib, I was freaking out. But anyways, that explains my stroke, I suppose, being in AFib 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. But right now I'm relying on a little pink pill called Eliquis to keep me from having another stroke. And I tell you, Chris, all the doctors, they talk about that drug like it's some miracle. But it's a little, you should see it. It's a tiny little pink pill I take twice a day, and it's supposed to keep me from having another stroke. If it is, God bless the medical pharmaceutical industry. But I'm putting a lot of faith in a little pink pill. So anyways, that's what's new. You're probably sorry you asked.
I wasn't sure you were going to go down that path. But
I'm being honest with our clients. I have to be. And I'm being honest with our listeners. Mm-hmm. I got nothing to hide. I want to help. In fact, the neurological unit or whatever of Anschutz reached out to me. They are going to come on the podcast.
What?
And, yeah, I didn't tell you that part. No. So there's another new thing.
Wow.
Anyways, I got to get back a hold of the woman. She called me several weeks ago, and I didn't get a hold of her because it was right around the time I was diagnosed with persistent AFib, and I started freaking out over that. But she contacted me. She would like to come on the podcast and talk about not only AFib, but strokes, the warning signs, what to do if you're experiencing one. Talk mm-hmm. about, I guess, things that I did right, which apparently I did, and I was lucky because I had. It's not like I sat around with a contingency plan if I had a stroke. I just kind of reacted. And she also asked, she said, would you like the doctor who performed your operation to be on the show? And at first I said no. I was like, no, I don't want to bother him and take his time. But then in hindsight, I thought, wait a minute, that might be pretty cool to have mm-hmm. him on the show too. So I can't say for certain I can get him on, but she did offer. Hmm. So I'm going to see if we can get him on. Okay. But I don't think we'll dedicate folks an EDU show to that or a Q&A. It'll just be a bonus show that we'll put out there when it airs. But I want to help people, Chris. That's why I'm sharing openly, folks, what I'm dealing with. I don't want other people to go through what I went through. Take AFib seriously. It is a very serious condition. There is no cure for it, from what all the doctors keep telling me. They can treat it, but they can't cure it. And especially, guys, if you're like me, I was diagnosed at 56. Remember that doctor who emailed me, Chris, and I read his email on the podcast? He said, I confused being fit with being healthy. And I was not healthy. And he put, in fact, I think his exact quote was, for whatever reason, mm-hmm. you decided to not take your AFib serious or something like that. But I remember it began with, for whatever reason. And I did, and I freely admit that. And I don't want other people to do that. Take it seriously if you get diagnosed with it. Or if you just kind of feel a little bit of weirdness in your heart, like I did for a long time, and the best description I can have, Chris, when I first started experiencing it, it felt like I was in grammar school, sitting there in class, waiting to get my report card.
Oh, that anxious feeling?
Yep. Hmm. I would get that feeling. And my doctor at first thought it was anxiety. I'm like, Doc, I don't have a wife. I don't have kids. I go home to a dog in a garden. What do I have to be anxiety over? I don't think it's anxiety. And we know now it wasn't. It was AFib. But nowadays, if you have the Apple Watch, I think you have to have the 6 like I do. You just have to touch the side of it with one finger while it's on your wrist, and it'll tell you in a matter of seconds if you're in AFib. So definitely take it seriously. And listen to the show on strokes as well. Hopefully, we're not going to talk finance on that show. I'm just doing it as a public service announcement to really get people to understand what can happen and take it serious. I've been given a second chance. I don't know why, but I have been. And I'll be darned, I'm going to do whatever I can to help as many people avoid what happened to me happening to them. All right. So you're probably bumming that you asked that question, Chris, but that's what's new.
No.
Okay. As always, we're going to lead with Social Security questions. If anybody has Social Security questions, please send them. We're down to two. And I think Chris is going to answer both of them today.
Perfect.
So we will have an opening if anybody has Social Security questions. Okay. You may need a pen for this one, or paper, a pencil, or whatever it is
I'm ready.
Okay. Where is he from? We're going to call him George, even though that's not his real name. We're going to call him George to protect his anonymity. And he's a Marylander. So he's from Maryland. Okay. Hi. I just heard the December show discussing delayed Social Security credits, and I need clarification on what Chris described as it applies to me.
Okay.
I reached my full retirement age of 66 in October of 2018. Mm-hmm. You are definitely going to have to figure out when you think he was born, because I think that's going to play in this. I don't have my calculator on me. So when do you think his birthday was?
1952.
Okay. Well, you got the calculator, not me.
Yeah.
Okay. I reached my full retirement age of 66 in October 2018, and I'm currently collecting divorced spouse benefits while I continue to work. Uh-huh. I'm planning on retiring this year. He sent this to us in 2021. Uh-huh. This year, and switch to my benefits in October of 2021. This will allow my delayed retirement benefits to grow 2/3 per month, which, for simplicity's sake, is about $20 a month for each month I delay. On a side note, Chris says it will grow at 0.75% per month, but that is not correct. So I don't know if he's pointing out something you said that was wrong or he's wrong.
If I said 3/4, that was wrong. It is 2/3 because you earn 8% retirement credits, delayed retirement credits each year. So 8 divided by 12 is how you do that math, which is 2/3. So if I said 3/4, I was having a moment.
No problem. Okay. From what Chris described on the show, do I understand it correctly? If I switch to my benefits in October of 2021, Social Security will calculate my delayed retirement benefit increase in January of 2022 based on my age in December of 2020, and then apply that increase to October and, wow, this is going to be hard for listeners.
I know exactly what he's talking about. We've done a few shows on this about the application of the delayed retirement credits, the way that the Social Security Administration actually applies them to your record. And they have this funny way of doing it where they essentially apply them on a calendar year basis. Every December, they calculate them and they apply them in January. But for him, we're currently in 2021. As he delays till October of this year in his plan, the delayed retirement credits from January through October aren't going to be applied until January's of 2022 payment. So when he starts up in October, he's going to get the October payment, the November payment, and the December payment, excuse me. But it'll be missing 10 months worth of delayed retirement credits. He is delaying for a total of 36 months, 3 years. So he'll get all the delayed retirement credits through the end of 2020 that he earned, applied to his payments that he receives in 2021, and then they'll look at it again and say, oh, you delayed another 10 months into 2021. Let's award you those now as well. So there is this strange timing element with the application of those delayed retirement credits that goes away when you hit 70. When you hit 70 and you're claiming, they actually go to the trouble of calculating the full delayed retirement credits up to the moment you claim at 70, and they apply them all right away. But if you claim before that, and if those keeping track at home, he's going to be 69 in 2021. So he's not going to delay until 70. He's delaying just to 69. So he's going to face this timing of benefits issue. So the good news is it only affects a couple of his payments there, his October and November payments. I believe it will be applied to the payment he receives in January, but I'd have to look at that again. It's been a while since I've looked at that. So at most, he's going to have a slightly lower October, November, and December award, but then it all gets fixed. So it's not a real tragedy. It is a bit of a bummer, you don't get all of the delayed retirement credits up to the moment you claim. And so people might be saying, well, why doesn't he wait till the end of the year and do it? Well, then he's going to give up a couple payments and there's this trade-off and all that. So the math isn't super clean on that. It's not obvious that that's a good way to go. So I would say if he's planning to claim then and he's done all the numbers and it makes sense for him to claim in October of 2021, he should do that regardless of how this is going to work. But just realize he's going to get maybe a slightly lower benefit for that 2 to 3 month period than he was expecting. But then it'll all be fixed in January. And when I say fixed, they won't retroactively fix anything. These are lost dollars that you just never will see. They don't retroactively fix this, but the full benefits, the full 36 months worth of delayed retirement credits will be in effect January 1st of 2022. When he claims in October of 2021, he will only have received 26 months of credits. So there's 3 months of collecting where he's going to be missing 10 months of credits, and it's just how it all works out. So that, I believe, is the essence of his question. Yes, he pointed out if I misspoke and said 0.75% per month, that was incorrect. 2/3 is the correct number. But his bigger question was the timing of those credits. And he's got it figured. What he mentioned is correct. What he was trying to describe, I believe he was correct.
Okay, fair enough. And I think you covered the rest. I didn't finish his question, but let me just see. You answered all his questions in that. Okay, next Social Security question, which is kind of Social Security-isk. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he begins, and where is he from? Signs his name George, so he's on to a little game here, but he doesn't say where he's from. Wait a minute, go Bills, so he must be New York. I live in New York. Mm-hmm. Okay, and go Bills. Okay.
If I lived in New York, I would say go Bills as well. Well, they're my preferred New York team.
So you're not a Jets fan or a Giants fan?
No. Okay. Never have been a fan of many of them, but I'm a fan of Josh Allen, so that's why I like the Bills.
Gotcha. Oh, because he went to University of Wyoming. Mm-hmm. Did you go there?
I did. It's where my undergraduate degree is from.
Your alma mater.
We all have a inferiority complex in Wyoming because everyone always overlooks us. So whenever someone succeeds coming out of the University of Wyoming, it's worth kudos and notifying or noticing it. So I always I liked him in college too. I thought he was underrated. And anyway, Buffalo Bills are now realizing the smoking deal they got on Josh Allen.
Yeah, that they did. All right, so this is a New Yorker. He begins, "Hi Jim and Chris. First of all, you do an outstanding job on the podcast. Don't change a thing. Excellent listener. We will
except when I say 3/4, and I should have said 2/3.
Well, I didn't go back and listen to that show, so maybe you did not say 3/4. I don't know.
I don't recall.
Okay.
It's possible.
Your long answers and comments are perfect, and your personality and Chris's play off each other very well. Now to my question. My Social Security benefit estimate states if I continue working until 67, my benefit will be $3,300 a month. Mm-hmm. But what if I retire at 55 and don't claim until 67? Will my benefit be less than that?
I have an excellent answer.
Well, you want to answer that? Or you want me to keep reading?
Well, the answer so far is maybe. That's unfortunately. But you can go on with the rest of it, and maybe the rest of his question will give me more information.
Okay. He hopes to retire. I should have predicated, folks. He sent like three paragraphs before setting up his situation. I'm going to back up into that, Chris, so they kind of know what his situation is. He hopes to retire, folks, at 55. By then, they anticipate having about $2 million in always taxable accounts. But an additional, Chris, and this is what will come into play, $1.2 million of deferred income that he will receive when he retires. Okay? Mm-hmm. So he goes on to say, my deferred income with my employer will pay out once per year for 11 years once I separate from my company. This deferred annual income will be about one-third of my current annual income. Will this deferred income from 55 to 65 be subject to Social Security taxes, and therefore the $3,000 a month estimate for my Social Security, $3,300 a month estimate for my Social Security at age 67 will not be too far off? Can I get a more accurate Social Security benefit estimate based on my situation? And that's his question.
Okay. So, a couple things here. When you look at the estimate for your Social Security benefit on the official Social Security benefit estimate statement, they've made a few assumptions. One of the key assumptions is that you will continue to earn what you did last year up until you claim. So when you look at the age 62 benefit, the full retirement age benefit, and the age 70 benefit estimates that are on the statement, they're assuming that you're going to work and earn what you earned last year up until you're 62 or 67, if that's your full retirement age, or 70. And if you don't do that, it might change the numbers in your earnings record to the extent it will reduce your benefit itself. But they may not. And that's why I said maybe before. By the way, if you don't have earnings last year, they'll look at the year before that and they'll assume you're going to make that. And if you don't have any earnings in the last 2 years, they're going to assume you have zero earnings up until the point where you claim. So that's the official assumption set that they've got going in those benefit statement estimates. So for his case, when he looks at that estimate, they're looking at it and looking at his compensation last year, and they're saying, well, if you work till you're 67 and continue to make the same amount, your benefit's going to be $3,300. When he says, what if I claim at 50, or what if I quit or retire at 55, how will that change it? It might change it. It might not. It depends on what his earnings record looks like before 55. If he has 35 years of really strong earnings by the time he's 55, there might be no effect. He might have no reduction. But if the earnings they're assuming that he would have between 55 and 67, each of those years is replacing crappy years of earnings in the past that he had, thus really having an effect on that 35 that they use to calculate his benefit, then if he stops work that much earlier than they're assuming, then there would be a noticeable reduction in that benefit estimate. So it all comes down to his actual earnings record. I'm guessing, though, and this is where the forensic analyst in me comes in, the fact that he has $1.2 million of deferred comp means he's been at a good-paying job for a while. So he may very well have a really strong earnings record up to 55 already. So stopping work before Social Security assumes he will may not have much of an effect at all. Getting to the deferred comp, the second part of his question is, if quitting before 67 is going to undermine it, will this deferred, he called it deferred income, I'm pretty sure he's talking about a what's called a non-qualified deferred compensation plan, where you defer current income and then you receive it, like he is, over a certain set period of time. It's different than a pension that will go for a lifetime, typically. This is payment. Essentially, they didn't pay you while you were working. They're holding it back. They're deferring it. And then they're going to pay it to you over a, I've seen it over 5 year, 7 year, 10 year, etc. For him, it sounds like it's 11 year period. And then it stops. Well, with those plans, with almost no exception. Actually, I've never seen an exception. I believe there might be exceptions, but I've never seen an exception. When the deferral happens while you're still working, the payroll taxes have been paid. So your Social Security and Medicare taxes have already been paid on that. So for purposes of Social Security, it looks like you've made all that money already. When they pay it out to you, it will be exposed to income taxes. But Social Security won't even really know about it. They've already recorded it, which if you're a high enough paid employee, you're probably well above the annual Social Security taxation maximum, which just for record for 2021, any earnings above $142,800 are not taxed for Social Security. So if this person, just out of, just as an example, if he made $200,000 in 2021 but deferred $50,000 of it, that $50,000 is going to have no impact, even though they're going to pay it to him later. It's not going to be recorded for Social Security taxation purposes because in the year he was awarded it, back when he truly earned it while he was still working, in my example, 2021, it was in excess of the Social Security maximum taxable earnings cap. So unfortunately, the fact that it's going to, that $1.2 million is going to pay out to him over that 10-year period, it isn't the same as having a job that's paying you $100,000 a year for that 10-year period for purposes of your earnings record at Social Security, because they're not collecting FICA taxes on that during that payout of the deferred comp period after you've quit. They've already included it in the payroll taxes when you earned it when you were working. So I think there's probably, that's the bad news. The good news is I'm betting if he were to do the calculations to figure out what his benefit would really be, retiring at 55, but then not claiming till 67, he'll find that it probably erodes a little bit, but not as much as he might expect. Because I suspect he has a pretty good earnings record already up to the age of 55. There are calculators that will calculate that. You actually enter your true earnings record. It's a little hard to find, but if you go to the Social Security website, ssa.gov, they do have some calculators on there, and you can put in the changed assumptions that we just talked about. Instead of using what the benefit statement's assumptions are, you're going to continue earning what you did last year all the way till 67. You can alter that assumption and say, what if I earn zero? And then they'll spit out a new estimate for you. So I don't think the Social Security one is as user-friendly as some of the other tools that are available on the internet, but there's a number of free tools on the internet now where you can calculate your Social Security's estimate. I actually have an Excel spreadsheet that does it as well. I don't use it much because there's been a lot of these tools pop up online, and we subscribe to some software that will do this for us and spit it out in a nice report, which is a lot more advanced than my Excel spreadsheet. But if you can't find anything, listener, contact me and I'll shoot you a copy of my Excel spreadsheet. It has to be updated every year, but it will give you an idea of how much it will affect you by not having those earnings in the last 10 years. I don't like my Excel spreadsheet as much as these other tools because mine is kind of backward-looking instead of forward-looking doing projections. So you might be better off using one of these online tools. But
I would recommend the tool because you're not going to be able to update it every year for someone.
No, I'm not going to do that. I use it as a plaything in class just to show students how it breaks down step by step in calculating the benefit. But
oh, that must really excite a 20-year-old learning how
Social Security works. If they're in retirement planning or financial planning courses, they're fascinated.
Are they? All right.
Yeah. Well, they better be, or they've picked the wrong major.
True. Right. All righty. Well, this gentleman has a pot due to his question, which doesn't really have to do with Social Security, so this is a good segue into the non-Social Security questions. So the first non-Social Security question comes from the same listener from New York who is a Bills fan. With my pension and Social Security, I have a good foundation to help ensure my wife and I can meet our minimum dignity floor. I know companies do not like having pensions, though, due to the financial risk they impose on the company and the need to keep them funded. Let me pause there. And this man is correct. Companies don't like pensions, and that's why a lot of pensions are gone. You normally find pensions now in governments and unions, two entities that are devoid of economic reality, as I like to say. But pensions are still big in the federal government and most state governments and even some local governments and some unions. But you'll find a lot of private employers don't have pension plans anymore. Now, some still do. Some very large, well-capitalized companies still have pensions. But I'll definitely say they are on the way out in popularity because the man is correct, listeners. The company is now responsible for taking care of your retirement. That's a huge burden on their shoulders forever. It's much easier to pass it on to you and put you in charge of handling your retirement. The risk is gone from the company and is now on to you, but the other risk now, Chris, on to people, and I'm sure you'll agree, with a pension, yes, all the risk is on the company, I'll admit that, but it's also on the personal level, if you will, pooled with hundreds or thousands of other retirees from that company. So one or two or three or four or even 10 or 20 or 30% of them can live much longer than life expectancy and collect much more than any actuarially sound person would have began collecting at the start of retirement, because there's always going to be people in that pool who weren't as lucky and pass away sooner and didn't collect nearly what they could have. And that actually spreads the risk out and makes it less risky for you as a pension recipient. But when you're doing it all on your own, as Chris always says, you got to get it right the first time. Correct, Chris?
Yeah, you're not pooling with anyone. So if you happen to be lucky enough to live long, that's unlucky in the financial planning world as far as funding goes, because that's going to put a lot of stress on your finances. So you don't benefit from this pooling idea. You're a pool of one. And so it makes things a little more challenging. You have more control, but you have an exposure that can't easily be mitigated if you're going to manage your retirement with simple distributions, which is the classic method. Just have to be aware that that risk is there. And there's different ways of addressing it. Some people address it directly. Some people don't. Some people, I think, don't even realize it's there.
And that's one of the reasons, hopefully you're listening to the show, but it's also one of the reasons Chris and I believe passionately in covering your minimum dignity floor, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses. Five categories, very broad categories, that can represent dozens upon dozens upon dozens of expenses. We get that. But we really believe in covering those with lifetime guaranteed secure income. That's why we call our process the Secure Retirement Income Planning Process, SECURE. We want that secure lifetime income. Minimum dignity floor expenses last forever, no matter how long you live. They should be covered by income that lasts forever, no matter how long you live. That way, at least part of your retirement, Chris, the most important part, the minimum dignity floor of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care, will be covered if bad things happen and your money begins to run out. So anyways, I kind of went off on a little tirade there, but I did want to point out to him, so far, everything he's saying is correct. Companies like to pass off pensions. But then he gets a little off base and confused on a few things. So he says, do you think it's likely that companies like mine, and he gives the name of his company, he asks that we don't mention it, but I will say it is a major, major firm, Chris, if I mention it. Everyone's heard of this company. It's a big company. It's an old, storied company, and will most likely be around for a long time. I would be surprised if anything ever happened to this company. Okay, so where did I leave off? Do you think it's likely that companies such as mine will buy out the pension benefits from retirees at some point in the future by giving them a lump sum payment and then stop their monthly pension for life? My concern is that if or when I'm, say, 70 years old or older, my former employer pays me a one-time pension buyout, which I assume they could do if they want to, and then I will lose an important piece of income and the certainty it provides me. So let me pause there, listener, and put your mind at ease. Your pension is protected by what, Chris?
ERISA.
ERISA. ERISA is not a person. ERISA is an act. It's a law. The Employee Retirement Income Security Act. ERISA. Your employer cannot just get a hold of you as a retiree and say, hey, we're not going to pay you a pension anymore. Here's a lump sum. Take it, leave it. We don't care. You're not getting anything anymore. They cannot do that. Now, they can voluntarily offer to buy people out,
right,
and they do that all the time. The fewer people they, or the more people that they can buy out, they especially buy out if they froze a pension. And even with a frozen pension, let's say your employer in the future, your ex-employer, when you leave, listener, decides to freeze their pension plan. Meaning all new employees are probably going to be in a profit-sharing plan or a 401k plan or something like that. And no new people going into the pension. That's a frozen plan. Mm-hmm. But they can't kick you out of the plan. You would be in there. All your benefits would have accrued up to the day that they froze the pension. But they're also going to entice you with pension buyouts at that point. And they're going to try to buy you out because they're trying to wind down the pension, but they cannot force you out. So whether they freeze it, which is what you're kind of describing, listener, and then seek volunteers to be bought out, it's still going to be your decision. They cannot just kick you out.
Right.
Now, the pension could declare bankruptcy. It could be bankrupt. It could not survive. The assets drop to such a level where the government steps in through the regulations and essentially force the pension to close down because the funding levels drop. Then the federal government would step in through the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which private pensions, not government pensions, but private pensions will pay into. And then the feds step in with limits. And you'll have to look those limits up, but within limits of what they would cover. But again, I don't see your employer falling victim to this, listener. But I did want you and all listeners who are contemplating a pension know they just can't boot you out. And I think that's what he thinks, Chris.
Yeah, sounded like it. He said he assumes they can do that. They can't just do that. Can a pension fail? Yes. But there are protections in for that. There's a lot of regulations around that. They also, in a bankruptcy situation, try to protect employees and the pension recipients as much as possible. And there's the PBGC, the Pension Benefits Guarantee Corporation, that steps in and can provide some extra support for a pension that's not fully funded that breaks down. And you can look up the limits on those. And if the pension that you're receiving is below the limits that they guarantee, you're in pretty good shape, even if your company was struggling and on the verge of failure, if you will. The limit that they'll pay out depends on the age you are when the pension itself falls apart. But for a lot of people, it covers their pension. Now, some people have really massive pensions, a handful of people, and they could be in for what we call a haircut, right? But for most people, between the resources that are still in the pension, the pension doesn't just dry up and have nothing in it. It just can't support 100% of the payout promise. The pension will be able to support some level, and then the PBGC comes in and adds additional support. And for a lot of people, they have a small effect, not no effect. I've seen some people where, once it goes on PBGC, I think sometimes cost of living adjustments, which not many private pensions have, but those can be on the chopping block, and you might lose some at the margins, but it suddenly going away or them coming and saying, nope, no more monthly payments, you're going to take this lump sum instead, those things just don't occur.
Right. Last time I checked, it was 50-something thousand. I don't know if it's been increased.
Depends on the age. The older
correct,
you are,
yeah.
the higher that number.
Exactly.
And I've seen, depending on age, some of the limits are up over double that.
Yeah, so you really have to look. And again, listeners, not going to help you because you're talking what ifs. But you could look at what if something happened to your company's pension when you're 75, 80, and get an idea of what you might receive in today's dollars and compare it to what your pension might be in today's dollars. And it'll give you an idea if the Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation would cover all of it or not. But what I just want you to know is they cannot just force you out. They can buy you out, and they'll present those offers all the time, but they can't force you out. But what they can do is they can sell your pension obligations to an insurance company. And firms do that all the time. In other words, the administration of the pension, they sell it to an insurance company. The insurance company takes over the pension, the administration of it, the payments from it, the running it, and they just kind of buy it out and take it over. So you could see that happening in the future, perhaps, but I'm not saying for certain that would be there. And ERISA still protects you. They can't sell you or sell your pension to an insurance company who turns around and says, hey, we're going to cut your benefit. It's way too high. We don't want to pay that much. They can't do that. So just keep that in mind. But he then ends, Chris, and says, if he took the lump sum, he still thinks that they're going to force him out. They cannot force you, listener, but let's play along with the rest of your question. If I take that lump sum and purchase an annuity, I assume I am not going to be able to fully replace the monthly pension benefit I enjoyed up until that time. Let me pause there. I can all but guarantee any lump sum payment you receive most likely would not pay you enough in a private annuity, because annuities are going to price their payments based on current interest rates, whereas your pension was based on your salary. And with interest rates being at these historically low rates and will probably stay at these rates for quite some time, I don't see you ever receiving more with a lump sum payment. Chris and I point that out to potential clients all the time, that it's very rare that you can take a lump sum, replicate the pension benefit you would have received with a private annuity and maybe had money left over. I just don't see that happening. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I agree. And actually, I'm on the pbgc.gov website here with the current table if people are interested. These numbers will vary depending on if your pension has a survivor benefit and the age of your spouse or the survivor. So these are general statements. But for a 65-year-old single life pension, the monthly maximum guarantee from PBGC is $6,000 a month. So right at $72,000 a year at age 65. At 75, it's over $18,000 a month they'll guarantee. So if your company goes bankrupt later on after you've been collecting it for a while and then gets, interacts, we'll call it, with the PBGC, the limits might be well above what your pension amount. Some people have pensions bigger than these, but these are pretty hefty limits. So just so you know, you can go right to the pbgc.gov website. They put this table up here every single year. They've got the updated 2021 numbers on here. It's readily available. And you can verify with your HR department if your pension participates in the PBGC, which they almost certainly do if it's a pension of renown.
Okay. All right. So let's move on to a couple of other questions, get to some non-Social Security questions. This next one isn't really a question, Chris, from a listener. It was a question from a colleague of ours. Again, you know the colleague, but we should just reference him as Andy. And he had a question that I thought would...
You're going to reference him as what?
Andy. His name's Andy. We never say his last name.
Oh. Well, I was going to say, don't we need to call him George?
Oh. Well, no. We called Andy before.
Okay. Andy.
Yeah.
Like the guy on the foot of... on Toy Story, on the cowboy.
I have no idea. The only Andy I know
name?
Is Andy Griffith.
Oh, it's not... Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
Anyways, folks, a colleague of mine reached out with a question on the backdoor Roth that I answered for him, but I thought this would make a good thing to mention on the podcast as well. So Andy had a client, or has a client, who was doing the backdoor Roth. So hopefully all of you understand what it is. We call it a backdoor contribution. Sometimes you'll hear it called a backdoor conversion. There's no, in my opinion, no such thing as a backdoor conversion because anyone can do a conversion.
Right through the front door.
Not everyone can do a contribution. So that's why we call it a backdoor contribution on this show. Anyways, he has a client who was doing the backdoor and doing it kind of on autopilot, he had said. And was just putting $7,000 a year into an IRA and then converting it to a Roth IRA. So he kept doing it, but he also retired. So what had happened is he had several years' worth of contributions into an IRA that he converted into a Roth IRA. Was it several years or was it 1 year's worth? Let me see. 1 year's worth. 1 year. Before they caught it. So he ended up making an excess contribution, folks, to an IRA. He wasn't eligible to put money into an IRA.
Because he didn't have earned income.
Correct. He stopped working, but the following year he did it. The following year after that is when Andy found it. So they had 1 year where $7,000 was put into a traditional IRA and then converted to a Roth IRA. Okay? Then the following year, it was discovered. So they thought they were in a conundrum. The excess contribution was made to a traditional IRA. But the current Roth custodian pointed out to them, if you want to remove the excess contribution, you're going to have to take it from the Roth. And they were saying, well, no, we made the excess to an IRA. We got to put the money back in an IRA and take it out of the IRA. And they were worried with the inability to do a recharacterization, the ability to undo the conversion, get the money back into an IRA and take the excess out of the IRA, they felt they were in a conundrum now and they didn't know what to do. So what I simply explained to them, and if anyone finds themselves in the same situation, do not worry that the excess contribution was made to an IRA and now the money is in the Roth IRA. It doesn't belong in the Roth, nor did it belong in the IRA. It doesn't belong in either one. You have until October 15th of the year following the excess contribution to the IRA. Not to the October 15th of the year following the conversion, Chris.
Right.
But from when the original excess contribution was made to the IRA. You have until October 15th of the year following. So if you made the excess contribution in 2020, say, You have until October 15th of 2021 to remove the excess contribution and not pay the 6% penalty tax. That's the first thing I wanted to point out. The second thing is just take it out of the Roth.
Yep.
Now, it's not just the $7,000. Here's where the calculation is going to get a little messy. You have to take, obviously, the $7,000 out, but you also have to take the net income attributable. I nailed it, right?
Pretty close to that last time, yeah.
Yeah, net income attributable. NIA for short. You have to take that out. What does that mean in English? You got to take $7,000 out plus all gains associated with that $7,000 minus all losses associated with that $7,000. It is not a straightforward calculation. It's a little bit convoluted. If you Google net income attributable and look it up, the IRS has a worksheet. Ed Slott has an article out there on how to figure it out. It can be done. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a little bit, you got to write some numbers down,
yeah,
but you can do it. So you've got to remove that from the Roth IRA. Now, keep in mind, what's going to end up happening is going to take a little while to clear the air here, and you very well may get a letter audit mm-hmm. from the IRS. So keep records. Keep very good records. That's what I want to say. So keep very good records. Because here's what's going to happen. Again, let's say that it was done in 2020. So you will receive, folks, a 1099 and a 5498 for 2020. The 1099 will show the money coming out of the IRA going into the Roth for the conversion. The 5498 will show the money going into the IRA as a conversion. So you're going to see I don't know if it'll be a contribution or a conversion on the 5498, but they're going to show on the 5498. So the IRS is going to see the money coming out of the IRA, and they're going to see it going into the Roth IRA. But you won't receive a 1099 until 2021 for showing the money coming out of the Roth IRA when you correct it. So keep good records. Keep the 1099 and 5498 from 2020. Keep the 1099 from 2021. And you don't need to file 5329, the mea culpa form, I usually call it. That's the form where you report the 6% penalty tax. If you can unwind this before October 15th of the year after the excess contribution right. to the IRA. If you miss that deadline, you can still undo it.
Just a little more paperwork.
But now you have to do 5329 and pay a 6% penalty tax on the excess contribution each year it stays in there. So anyways, I know a lot of our listeners like to do these backdoor contribution strategies, but if you ever muff it up, don't worry. You can take the money right out of the Roth IRA.
Yep. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that one. I don't think we've covered that one because people are getting more and more into this, making a non-deductible contribution to the IRA and then immediately converting it to the Roth. So I think it's going to happen more frequently when people, before people would notice the error, but it would be still in the account where they contributed in the first place. So they just go to that same account and take it out and fix it. Here, it was like hot potato, hit the traditional IRA and then jumped over to the Roth almost immediately. And, so it isn't in the account you put it in originally. So I could understand the concern that Andy and his client had in this particular case, but I think, the paperwork trail will be your savior. If the IRS comes a-knocking, as long as you got the paperwork and you did it legitimately, you're good to go, I think.
Exactly. And one other thing, folks, the reason this became a little bit of an item, if you will, a little bit of confusion, is there's no IRA left. In a perfect back door, you put $7,000 into an IRA, You convert the entire 7,000 IRA into a Roth IRA, and you do not have any existing IRAs. If right. you have existing IRAs, the back door doesn't work because of something called the pro rata rule, which gets way beyond the scope of this question I'm answering. So those of you who might be sitting there saying, well, there's more money in the IRA. Just take the 7,000 out of there. You won't have to deal with any of this stuff. No, in this situation, there was no other IRA. That was the problem. Because in a properly executed backdoor, Chris, you are getting rid of that IRA as soon as you convert it.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Well, we'll have to shut it off right there.
Really?
Yeah, we're at an hour.
Oh, I got a whole handful of questions I had here.
All right. We always have a handful of questions.
Well...
You seem so hurt.
Well, I spent all this time digging out all these questions. I have them in order that I wanted to answer them. We need another Q&A show.
Yeah, we're going to have one.
We are? When?
Next week.
No, I mean two a week, not just
easy,
one a week.
Easy.
I can hardly get you in here to do one a week.
Yeah, I know. True. But before we hang up then, real quick, we have another. We got tons of book recommendations. Keep them going, folks. Mm-hmm. This one I liked. Hmm. This one made me smile. So this person says, I have a book recommendation for you. Mm-hmm. I recommend you write a book. Then Chris can make it into a textbook for his class. And then you will have guaranteed sales. And then update it every year so that the used books are no longer good and can't be used.
Oh, he's hip to the college textbook game.
I know. Yeah. And the students are required to buy a new book every year. Mm-hmm. I think...
He might be onto something there.
Well, not that he's onto something. I think he may have kids in college. Yeah. And he's on to the game.
Yeah.
So I think you should write a textbook, Chris. Change it every year and get on that gravy train.
By the way, listener, that practice annoys me to no end as well. Unless it's a textbook that's talking about cutting edge new things in the topic area that needs to be revised every year, this whole schedule of revising these textbooks for principles of fill in the blank or fundamentals of fill in the blank. The reason why they're principles or fundamentals is because they're the basics that have been established over usually decades. That stuff doesn't change every 2 years. Are you kidding me? So I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent, but that's highly annoying to me as an instructor and as a parent who has kids in college. But I was watching out for college kids in this regard well before, because even back when I was in college, eons ago, we were starting to see this happen. Textbook prices were starting to really go up. So as a instructor, I've done my best to pick affordable books, honestly. If a book that costs half or a third of what the others do can get the job done, I do that. Even though it's not money out of my pocket, right? There's somebody paying that. And I think that's ridiculous, the price of some of these books now. And then brand new ones coming out every other year. It's terrible. Anyway.
Now, I do all my reading on a Kindle now for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. I use the Kindle app on my iPad. And the books are significantly less than what I would pay for the hardcover or the paperback. I'm not in college. I don't have kids in college. Can they get a Kindle version and save significant?
Effectively, yes, because the publisher knows they can't resell it. They usually make it online only. That it's not downloadable. You have to look at it online only. And then they'll price it a lot lower because they know they're going to sell the next student one. You can't resell that in the used bookstore. So, yes, they are less expensive.
So it's not a Kindle reader. You have to go online and read it.
Generally, yes. There's a few that are downloadable, but the most of the publishers want to control your ability to resell it, and that's why they're willing to sell it to you for maybe 60 or 70% of the price of the printed book, because they know it's worthless at the end of the semester. Whereas the printed book at least has some used value afterward. So
what a racket. That's
well, they're
racket.
All they're eating each other now because all the publishers are finding this model unsustainable and are merging and doing all kinds of things. So there is pressure being put on these publishers for this. I don't know how it's all going to play out, but I think you're going to find a lot more places not using traditional textbooks. There's so many other resources that are out there that you don't necessarily need a traditional textbook in a lot of cases.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, that's one reason I didn't have kids.
Yeah.
I don't have to worry about college.
So, well, thanks everybody for listening to another show. If you want to send in your own questions, like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, just go to jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, there's a contact form where you can send the email directly to Jim, jim@jimhelps.com. He's the assembler of the questions, so you can get your question inserted into his pile.
Anybody send a Social Security question before next week?
Oh, get right to the top of the list.
We don't have any more.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah. So Social Security questions, here's your chance to get right to the top. Send those in. We'd appreciate it. And we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.